Blog Talk Radio.
Here we go.
This is All About Wine, the talk show dedicated to the wine industry since 2009, featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast and around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's
Okay. All right, people. Thank you. There we go.
All right.
They were happy the storm's done.
Yes. Anything to get out of the storm.
It's an important storm. We had a storm go through today here in Florida. It worked its way from all that nasty weather you guys are having up north this week, and it spun a little tail of that storm through us. And we got some thunder and lightning and heavy rains and tornado warnings. Just a nasty front that went through, cooled off behind it, and only supposed to get up to 68 tomorrow.
For the high?
And for the high, 68 tomorrow. Then another front supposed to come through tomorrow evening, and the high Saturday is only supposed to be 65. And that.
What are we in the mountains all of a sudden? What's going on?
Yeah, I know. This is not good. We didn't move to Florida for this frigid air. We can go bundle up, get the parkas out and the long johns, and we'll make it through the couple. They say it's supposed to be cool for the next 5 or 6 days, and then we're supposed to warm up a little bit again. But I don't know. Who knows? It's a guess. Yeah.
Looks like speaking of guests, it looks like we have somebody on the line holding from Missouri, I think, if I memorized all the area codes in the United States correctly.
813 is Missouri.
813 is Tampa. You're in 813.
Oh, yeah, that's right. 816 is Missouri. Well, I should know that because I think that must be our guest, Doug, because I think Doug is originally from Kansas City, Missouri, which is where I'm from, and 816 is my area code. So why don't we bring him on and talk to him?
Perfect.
Hello, Doug. Welcome to All About Wine.
Well, hello. How are you?
I'm doing really well, and glad you're able to join us tonight.
Well, my pleasure.
You are where, in Kansas City right now?
Well, actually, no, I'm in Seattle today. I'm doing a dinner with Echolands Wine, the winery that I co-own and run.
Oh.
And so I'm doing a dinner at a restaurant in Seattle this evening.
Oh, I see. Well, I looked at your 816. I understand you're originally from Kansas City.
Well, originally from Portland, Oregon, but I've lived in Kansas and Missouri really most of my life. So, I reside in Kansas City these days.
I see, because I was born and raised in North Kansas City, and that's why I was kept going back to it, wondering. So, what part of Kansas City were you in, or are you?
I live in Prairie Village. So.
The
perfect village, as everyone likes to ridicule us. So.
Yeah, I know. It always has been. You know, even when I was growing up.
Yeah.
Oh, Prairie Village.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It has to be said with a sneer. So.
Yeah, this is exactly. That's the only way you say Prairie Village. Yeah, so. Okay, well, we got that established. So, you were going to be a guest on. You got hung up on a dinner party, and we missed you, but I'm glad you're able to come back tonight. You are quite a busy person.
Well, you know, I'm never bored. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, that is for sure. You have yourself all sorts of accolades. You have yourself something that very few people have. In fact, only four people in the United States or world, is it?
In the world, yeah.
In the world, only four people in the world hold simultaneously Master Sommelier and Master of Wine titles, and you are one of those four. That is really quite impressive, if I may say so.
Well, you know, living in Kansas City, we just have a lot of time to drink and read. So, yeah, it still works out.
Yeah, well, no, yeah, well, that's a good point. Tell me, I'm really curious of your journey from, from Portland to Kansas City most of your life to holding double titles that only four people in the world hold. What took you on this path, and what got you to do this?
Well, I started in the restaurant business when I was 14 years old, washing dishes, and pretty quickly figured out there was better money to be made out on the floor. So I ended up, being a waiter, being a sommelier, being a manager, beverage director, et cetera, various iterations of that life. And then ended up starting to work as a wholesaler and then importing and that sort of thing. And in the midst of all that, discovered that these exams existed and thought, hey, I want to do that. And so I kind of jumped into the Master of Wine exam first and then discovered the Master Sommelier exam in the midst of all that and thought, that sounds great too. And I don't want to ridicule or, seem flip about it all, because as soon as I actually sat in one of these classes, I realized, oh, these are my people. This is my tribe. I want to hang out with these people. I don't give a shit if I, pardon my French, I don't give a shit if I pass or not. I just want to hang out with these people.
It's like this.
Yeah, yeah.
How similar is the Master Sommelier class as opposed to the Master of Wine?
Well, I usually like to say that the Master Sommelier is an exam that tests your ability to be fast on your feet, to serve maybe a table full of surly Master Sommeliers, to be sort of the ultimate wine host. And that's kind of the best way to think about it, though there's lots of minutiae and blind tasting involved. Whereas the Master of Wine is more about, can you sit down and we hand you a subject and you can write a ready-to-publish essay on each of these questions in 2 hours, go. But it also includes lots of wine tasting. So they're, they're the kind of the same set of information, but two different ways of interacting with that information.
Wow. We have had people on the show who have tested into the Master of Wine. They said it is a very hard test. Very few people pass it the first time because it is such a hard test. And to hold both the titles, I am really quite impressed of your abilities to do that. That is great. We wanted to get you on the show for a reason that you were judging You were judging a Pinnacle of Wine, Wine Pinnacle Awards.
The Wine Pinnacle Awards, exactly. And we've been doing that for a few years, and that's a really fun event, and I think that's kind of how the connection was first made between us.
Yes, it was. But explain to people out there what the Pinnacle of Wine Awards are and our Wine Pinnacle. I said that backwards. Wine Pinnacle Awards are, and what it involves and all that.
Sure. So this is a program, or I should say a competition amongst wines, and I suppose amongst wineries as well. But it is indeed a competition that sort of defines itself differently and goes about its business differently. I having been involved in many wine competitions and run some as well and continue to do so for a few decades, most of the wine competitions work in the fashion that you send out invitations or you alert people to the competition. they pay a fee to enter their wines. The wines are tasted blind, and then people issue awards. For the Wine Pinnacle Awards, our intention was to no longer say you've got to pay a fee to be in, to no longer say you've got to fill out this paperwork and register to be in. What we're going to do instead is we're going to pick about 100 of the most knowledgeable people we know, a lot of MSs and MWs amongst others, and say to them, okay, you taste a lot of wine. Throughout the past year, what's the very best, let's say, South American wine that you've had? What's the very best Syrah that you've had? What's the very best Riesling that you've had? And so we let all those people nominate wines, and once we sort of settle on which wines received a certain amount of nominations, then again, anonymously, we let people then, that same group of people vote on which wine is actually going to receive the award. So, you know, nobody pays a fee to be in it. It's not limited to just those wines that get sent in, because probably not surprisingly, in most competitions, wines that have already proven themselves to be really great are very unmotivated to enter their wines into somebody's competition. You know, they already proved that. It's only downhill from here, you know. So it was conceived by a master of wine named Jeannie Cho Lee. And so, you know, one of the ideals of her conception was, and it's going to be international in scope. So often, instead, we, as people who organize competitions, tend to be sort of regionally focused, if not just nationally focused. So this is, you know, we pick international judges and do our best to make sure those judges are diverse and dispersed, if you will, around the globe. So people in Northern Europe, Southern Europe, South Africa, South America, North America, Asia, et cetera, all are amongst the judges that are being given an opportunity to nominate and to weigh in on the final judgment.
Great. Why have they not had more competitions like this? It just seems like this is really a good way to find out some of the, well, pinnacles of the wine world without having to worry about all the, well, entry fees and everything else.
No, I quite agree. And that was certainly the goal and the hope.
Yeah. If you look at my listeners in past episodes, I'm not a big one on wine competitions, because a lot of them, if you pay your money, you're guaranteed a medal. First, second, or third place, if you pay your money, you're going to walk away and say, oh, look, I've got medals. And the public doesn't realize how insignificant that is. But in the wine world, we say, okay, well, we paid our entry fee and we get ourselves a medal, and it just sort of washes it down. Something like the Pinnacle Awards, it's really on the merit of the wine itself. You have absolutely nothing to do except the motivation of making a good wine.
I would agree. I think the idea certainly is that these judges are, I wouldn't say impartial, because at the end of the day, that's one of the things I like about wine, is that we all have favorites and we all have wines we're in love with. And, you know, I think that emotional connection is what's supposed to make wine cool and wonderful and fulfilling and all that stuff. So I like that instead of, you know, sort of trying to back away from it or pretend that there aren't prejudices, instead it's that you get enough people together that instead you get, you know, what you hope is a diverse set of prejudices about wines and what makes, you know, the best Bordeaux or the best Burgundy or the best Champagne or, you know, the best North American Cab or what have you.
And you mentioned, you know, a set of wines there. What is the breakdown? Do they have it apples to apples, or do they separate it by countries, or how is that done?
It changes every year. There's certainly, you know, we look to try to find the strength of any particular region or country, if you will. So there is a category, you know, there's no dedicated category for, let's say, California Chardonnay. there is a dedicated category for white Burgundy, which is, of course, Chardonnay based. And then there's a category just called best other Chardonnay. So that best other Chardonnay could be from New Zealand, it could be from Australia, it could be from Italy, it could be from North America, you know, et cetera. So, and each year, particularly when it comes to categories like Champagne or Bordeaux or Burgundy, we actually will say, okay, from X vintage. And in so doing, what we're also trying to do is to say, so with this group of people who've been consuming all these wines and one hopes really know a lot of these really, you know, wonderful wines, instead of saying, hey, what's the best champagne you had last year? It's like, hey, hang on a minute. 2012 is one of the greatest vintages champagne has produced. Let's say, you know, now with them being 10 years old, what really now, 10 years on, can we say that was the best damn champagne in the vintage? And so, you know, that I think, you know, we felt like, again, that's a strength that we can bring to this particular style of competition, because the wine doesn't actually have to be sitting in front of a group of people on a given day at a given time. We can go ahead and have a little more fun with it. And like I said, actually for some areas, go ahead and call out a vintage and say, yeah, you know, let's talk about this particular vintage. And with the benefit of hindsight now, say, you know, what really is the most exciting amongst those wines of that really famed vintage?
Oh, that's fantastic. That would be a great way to do it, because, you know, if you're judging the, well, Burgundies now, compared to some of the great vintages over the last 15 years or so, are you going to compare to when they were first released? Are you going to compare to how they've aged and all that? And there's so many different factors in there. So,
yeah, it's really true. So it's a fun exercise. In some ways, it's a, you know, like a really elaborate thought experiment.
Yeah, I like that. That's fun. Yeah, indeed. Not to put you on the spot, but what are some of your favorite wines?
Well, I always, well, I'll put it this way. I was certainly one of those people that said, we damn well are going to choose a best Riesling. And, you know, it's all in all likelihood going to come from Germany, even though Austrian Riesling can be exciting. There's a wonderful Riesling made in a lot of other places.
But all over the world.
I also, yeah, exactly. But I also pushed for a category that I suppose is for some people sort of silly, but I thought it was particularly important as we kind of, like everybody, had to rethink the way we did things in you know, during the pandemic. So we have a category called comfort wines, best comfort white wine, best comfort red wine, best comfort rosé. And, you know, that's pretty ill-defined. But I think everybody knows what it means, you know?
Exactly.
It's like, this is the wine I just want to sit down and have a bottle with, and I don't give a damn, you know, if I have it with somebody else or if I'm drinking by myself. You know, there's a lot of really, you know, sexy, wonderful wine that you would only have, you know, in a certain setting with a certain group of people, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But when I sit down and I have a bottle of, like, you know, Morgon from Beaujolais, I'm okay if I just drink a half a bottle by myself and, you know, save the rest for when my wife feels like having a glass.
Uh-huh. I know. It's the comfort wine category. I read that in the release here, and I thought that was one of the better categories of all of them, to be honest with you, because so many people, well, it's a default wine. You always go back to your default wine, the one that you enjoy and you know you're going to enjoy it. And no matter how many times people say, well, this is a great vintage, or this is a great wine, or you start saying, okay, should I try this? And then you reach up and you grab your default wine, your comfort wine, and you know you're going to like it, and you know you're going to enjoy it, and you go to that. And that's why I love that category, because there are some great comfort wines out there that never get recognized as such. And so, good. It's a good category.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, it is. So tell us about your winery. How long have you had it? What do you produce? Where is it located? All that good stuff.
Sure. My business partner and I started the winery in 2017. We started the project in 17, bought some land in 2018 in Walla Walla Valley, on the Oregon side of Walla Walla Valley, and have since bought some land on the Washington side of Walla Walla Valley. So we own some vineyard property on either side of the valley, and are in the process of building a winery right now. But we've been making wine at a rented facility, if you will, since 2018. So we just concluded our fifth harvest. And the kind of the bulk of what we make is either a Bordeaux blend, you know, Cabernet-based Bordeaux blend, or Syrah. And then we make some other things, some, you know, fun stuff like a fun Grenache, a Pet Nat, a Cabernet Franc. And as well, we make some single vineyard Bordeaux-style blends. And then this year, we've made rosé and we've made a white wine, too, because our own vines came of age this year. And we had some Sauvignon Blanc and some Semillon that we are bottling up, probably sometime in the late spring.
Oh, sounds exciting. A Cabernet Franc. It's really sad, in my opinion, that that is not made and bottled under its name more often. It just seems like people use it as a blending grape and don't give it the credit that it deserves. I love a Cabernet Franc.
I could not agree more. No, and I have to say, really, it's one of the things that drove me to Walla Walla Valley is I really think Cab Franc there is special. And so, you know, we don't produce a lot of varietally bottled Cabernet Franc. It does get blended into some of our other wines, but we are definitely growing the Cab Franc. I mean, at this point, we make 400 or 500 cases of Cab Franc, and we'll continue to make more. Let's put it that way. As our vines get older, as we get our hands on some other of our neighbors' grapes when they're willing to sell them to us, I'm kind of all in on Cab Franc.
I have always been. It's that and Barbera is two of my favorite grapes. And South America, I like the Carmenere, but the Cab Franc is just one of those grapes that, if put in good hands, makes a wine that will outshine just about every other red wine out there. I mean, it just I just really love the complexity of it. And
yeah, I do too. I'm very happy with what we've been able to get so far.
Yeah, well, that. How many acres do you have of everything? You said you've got vineyards. Well, what do you have?
We have about 25 planted acres.
Wow.
But we own about 400 acres outright now. Like I say, only a small portion of that is planted, and we're going to go slow. But that's where we're building our land purchase that we made on the north side of Walla Walla Valley, the Washington side. That's where we're building our winery right now, and that is going full force despite the winter weather. The contractor doesn't seem to care.
You all got hit in the last couple of weeks there too. Oh my gosh,
it's true. But our contractor's like, yeah, bumping the road, we're going.
What is the name of the winery?
The winery is called Echo Lands, so Echolands, and part of that is just reflecting that I live far away. Both my business partner and I live far away in Kansas City, and so there's a bit of a, if you will, echo effect. You know, we obviously have a crew, and our winemaker, Taylor Oswald, lives full-time in Walla Walla and has for over a decade making wine up there. And so, you know, there's a dedicated group there, but I travel back and forth a lot. So the echo word kind of made sense to me. That and the land that we bought is not the sort of bottom land that a lot of people like to talk about in Walla Walla Valley, called the Rocks and places like that, which can produce really distinctive wines. But I was more interested in getting to elevated sites. And so there's, this commonality with our north property, the Sound of Music look. We've got a 360-degree view from our top hill that takes us up to 1,800 feet. And The other one has it sort of overlooks the very famous Seven Hills Vineyard, and there's like a little canyon there above Dry Creek, and so that has a little, you know, echo effect as well. So I thought the name was appropriate.
Are you in any AVAs there? Or
yes, so we're officially Walla Walla Valley.
Are you? Okay.
I would predict that sometime in the next couple of years, there's going to be a new AVA up there, something to do with the foothills of the Blue Mountains. And that's where we bought 340 acres of the 400 that we own, because I'm all in on that as well. I really believe that's a special site. And I think, you know, it's just the usual. We're just going to have to get all the cats herded into a room to agree on what the hell we are going to call this. So right now, I just call it the foothills of the Blue Mountains. I don't care what we call it; just call it something.
Yeah, you know? And give us an AVA.
That's it. Just give us a damn name.
And that's right. Yeah, you can call it anything. Just, you know, let's get on with it. What types of soil are you getting in the hills there, though? I mean, it can't be the same gravelly stuff that you get down at the bottom. So.
No, not at all. It is very different. The soil type, you'll hear various names, but basically the, you know, sort of broad category is loess. It's an Austrian word that really describes this windblown material that you'll find in places in Austria, but is very common to Walla Walla Valley. But you'll actually get that down in the Willamette as well. And it's all part of these materials that got hurtled up into the air during what are called the Missoula floods, which date back to 15,000 years ago at the end of the Ice Age. This massive lake that covered 25 square miles or more, and in some cases was several miles deep, broke as the glaciers began to melt and flooded the area. In fact, we know one of those floods was a 200-foot wall of water traveling 50 miles an hour from where Missoula, Montana is to the Pacific Ocean. So tore things up really good and hurtled all this material into the air, such that material still settles today to some degree, but, you know, spent a couple of centuries really settling. So most of our loess is this incredibly friable soil, you know, the roots can just jump right through it, and it takes you down to a layer of calcium carbonate. And so you get, you know, terrific drainage. But your worry is going to be that in a drought year you could be in trouble. So in most of those vineyards, you know, you're going to have to irrigate. Up in this new area where we bought and are planting vineyards, which I refer to as the foothills of the Blue Mountains, it's wet enough up there. You're actually benefiting from the proximity to the Blue Mountains, and so theoretically you don't need to irrigate up there, but again, if it's dry around harvest season, you can stress your vines out a little bit, so it's not a bad idea to have an irrigation line that you can tap into in that weird year when you need to.
A lot of people like that, stressing their vines right for harvest anyway, to get all that juice and sugars into the grapes. So
I tend to disagree with them.
I do too.
Because that's the prevailing wisdom, of course. You know, people talk about it all the time. But actually, having spent a good deal of time in Oregon years ago, people began to talk about something called stress vine syndrome. And it was really based upon, you know, post-veraison and when the grapes start to turn color. If the vine gets stressed out, it really starts to sort of feed on itself. And it doesn't, it's not good for the vine. And you can actually taste that flavor in the grapes that you end up, pardon me, the wine that you end up making from the grapes. So I remember that really, you know, evolved my thinking over the last couple of decades where I was like, you know, that's the one time you don't want to stress them out. There are other times when it's okay to stress them out, but not veraison and post-veraison.
I hear this quite often. You know, I like to stress the vines right, you know, leading up to harvest, because in that way they start concentrating that sugar into the grapes, and so I get that high Brix when I'm harvesting and all. And I'm thinking, wow, that's didn't sound like a good thing, but yeah, I never did.
Yeah, to each to his own.
Yeah, I never did. I never liked it. like the thought of that, but yeah.
Well, and we tend to pick before other people do as well, because I don't like those high sugars. I'm looking for something that is, you know, to my palate, more balanced. And I think part of it is just that the wines I fell in love with early in my career were, you know, California wines of the 60s and 70s. Those weren't high in alcohol.
Too.
You know, and European wines up until probably the, you know, their late 90s, early aughts, those weren't high in alcohol. That's not what people did. And so I'm trying to, you know, as much as we can. I mean, the highest alcohol wine we've made to date is 14.2%, and that was even a bit of an outlier. So, so we're just, you know, we're trying to stick to a style that we think is pretty.
Well, some of the wines coming out now, it's just outrageously high in alcohol. I mean, you're looking at
exactly.
16.5%, 17% alcohol, and those wines, you know, are so hot that it's just like, you know, if I want alcohol this high, I'll have myself a nice scotch.
I'm with you. It's not my style, and I don't want to criticize somebody else for being in love with that style, but you know, it just wears me out.
Yeah, and they're doing it, and I don't know why. You tend to lose different sublimities of the wine and different flavors with that alcohol so high. It just overpowers it. So, but yeah, that's just how we look at it. Are you going to go organic or biodynamic, which seems to be the thing now in vineyards? Are you looking at doing that?
We have been organic in our 25 acres up to now, but I'm not tied to that. And I'm one of those people that believes there's some good things about biodynamic viticulture, but there's also some things that really don't make a lot of sense. So I'm a bit of a skeptic about it. I'm not skeptical of the idea at all. I think I love, if you will, the sort of mantra of the biodynamic vineyard manager who says, you know, the most important input you can put in a vineyard is the winemaker's feet. And I winemaker's boots. And I really do agree with that. It's like, you know, that the idea that biodynamic teaches people to think about the vineyard as an ecosystem and not as a place where you grow grapes, I think is right on. But, you know, and some of the inputs I think are really great. But some of the stuff I think is based on pseudoscience. You know, it's over a century, ideas over a century old that were promulgated by a guy who was just as excited about eugenics and what we would today call, you know, racism as he was by the notion of practicing viticulture based upon what the earth wants and not necessarily what the farmer is trying to get this year. So we're trying to blend it, and I'd have to be honest to say I'm still trying to figure it out. You know, still trying to decide what's a good practice, what's nonsense, you know, what are we not doing that we should be doing. But yeah, I agree with the overall notion that you are supposed to make sure that this is a living place, and the grapes are just one of the things living there.
You know, a thought just occurred to me. And since you're here, you get to be the one to discuss it with me. The thought just occurred to me. You hear about biodynamics in grapes a lot. Is it that popular in other crops? I mean, we don't have the farmers in the Midwest doing biodynamic wheat or biodynamic corn.
Yes. Good point. It is something that's been discussed for many years, and it wasn't when Rudolf Steiner was talking about this, you know, 100 years ago. It wasn't just grapes that he was talking about. He was really just talking about farming in general and farming practices in general. So there are people who are biodynamically farming other fruit crops and other you know, crops in general. I don't know if anybody is doing biodynamic grain crop. I should probably know that, but I don't really know that offhand, because like you said, all we spend our time talking about is grapevine biodynamism and those practices in the vineyard. So it's a curious thing.
It would be a lot easier to bury a cow horn in a vineyard than it would be in a cornfield. I don't know. I hear about it. It just occurred to me that we're always talking about grapevines and the biodynamic I've got a blank. There's all the other new sustainable stuff and all that. And you hear a lot of this about grapevines, but
yeah, regenerative,
right? Yeah,
regenerative viticulture and all that. And I would say in general, we are practicing what people refer to as regenerative viticulture, but we're still evolving our practices and what's appropriate. It's really, really important to me that we have people would refer to as a living biome underneath the vines, that we are generating and helping grow mycorrhizal fungi, underneath the vines, that we're, concerned about what's growing under the vines just as much about how the vines themselves are growing.
And that really is pretty important. I mean, there's so much to come get in the ground and affect the grapevines. I when I had the winery, I was down here in Florida. We've got Glassy Wing Sharpshooter, and I'll tell you, you take care of it on the plant, and you've got all this cycle under the ground that you're not seeing, and it's a constant battle, and it's to be able to handle that. You can't tear up your ground, you can't tear up what you're trying to grow in just to kill something right then. And it's a battle, unbelievable battle that we're constantly fighting here in Florida.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's a funny irony in that when we first started, and the woman who is actually our vineyard manager for the Oregon property is a woman named Sadie Drury, and she's a great viticulturalist, and she's been a wonderful vineyard manager, but we were having this really kind of a long-term argument about tilling, no tilling. And I had told her I wanted to go to no till. And she said, look, I understand, but labor is an issue now. I can't guarantee you we're going to be able to do that. It's very time consuming and, yada, yada, yada. And so we were arguing about it. And then, phylloxera was discovered in Washington State. Now, I will argue that it's always been there, but most of the vines, the vast majority of vines in Washington State are unrooted. And so phylloxera will eventually destroy those vines, and that includes 23 of our 25 acres were unrooted as well. So, the the irony here is that as soon as phylloxera was discovered, that the best thing you can do is don't ever till. So suddenly no till was like, oh no, that's standard practice. I'm like, well, yay phylloxera, is this what I'm supposed to think now?
Yeah.
Phylloxera worked out.
Gave you credence to your argument.
It's one of those, all right, whatever, I guess that's how that works.
Yeah, that's funny. What a horrible way to go into it, though.
Oh, yeah. Now, phylloxera was discovered 2 months after we planted, planted two of their own roots. So it was, I did not lose my mind over it because, like I say, I was convinced it was already there. We just think, or at least some of us think, that phylloxera never really got much of a foothold, as I said, partially because of that dusty soil. It doesn't like sand. It likes, more clay kinds of soils, which we don't really have up here. And also, we used to get more intense winters. And so a lot of people think that the fact that climate change is cutting back on the intensity of our winters is the other reason why phylloxera is now an issue, and it's actually killing some of the vineyards. So people are going through the process of replanting now. And at some point we'll have to as well. And we're now planting on rootstock. But, there's 23 acres out there that I'm going to be keeping my fingers crossed over the next 20 years or so.
I sympathize with you because when you're sitting there looking at it, it's the same thing with Pierce disease and a Glassman sharpshooter here. You know, it you keep your fingers crossed that it's not going to affect anything, and you we can't find any vitis for Nephra because it'll get into it immediately. But they told us that we can't plant Norton. And a good friend of mine has a vineyard 20 miles from where I had one. He put in 10 acres in Norton, and everybody told him, you can't plant that. It's going to kill it and all that. And he planted it, and it started to grow, had it tested. It tested positive for Pierce disease, but it didn't do anything to the plant. Mm-hmm. The plant thrived
didn't
and grew
kill it.
And didn't kill it. And
that's awesome.
You know, and so when you start looking at the possibilities of something, maybe Norton has something in it, in the plant itself, that can fight it off. I mean, and it could happen to some of the plants that you have, too. I mean, it's you never know. Never know what's going to happen out there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's farming.
It is. Yeah, there you go. That's
just a
the
matter
bottom line.
Of managing the disasters. That's farming.
Yeah, exactly. You know. So is there a website for your winery yet?
Yes, absolutely. It's just echolandswinery.com.
Okay, very good. Yeah. Something else. Oh, languages. Do you speak anything besides English?
I barely can manage my way through French, German, and Spanish in under the right circumstances. So no, I make no such claims. But, you know, when I do travel, I manage to, you know, get fed and get from place to place, and that's probably about it. So, find a bed.
Where is the,
you know,
where is the bathroom? Where is the hotel?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I still remember.
It's actually my. Yes, of course.
No, go right ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I still remember my very first trip to France when I was probably 21 and walking up to a manager and saying, "La toilette, s'il vous plaît." And he said, "Yeah, it's around the corner to your left." Like, you know, I was probably 5 feet before I went, "You asshole. God, really? So obvious."
That's a funny story. I like that.
The bastard.
Yeah, really.
You couldn't cut me some slack, could you?
Yeah, he could have. He probably loved to do it that time.
Oh, I'm sure he was like, this guy's American, I can tell.
I can tell right away. You know, he just, you know.
Yeah.
Well, look, he's from Kansas. What can we say? You know.
What can we say? That's exactly right.
What can we say? The Pinnacle Awards. I want to hit on that again. Those are always held in the same place over in Singapore, or those rotate?
Yes. Yes. No. We go to Singapore. These days, once a year. I mean, the pandemic obviously goofed all that up, but that's the way we roll. You know, when the pandemic is not destroying everybody's lives. So, so yeah, indeed, we'll be back there in 23, and just got back about a month ago from having the Pinnacle Awards in Singapore. And Singapore is a hell of a place to eat, so I'm happy to get there.
Oh, I can imagine. Never had the opportunity, but boy, it sounds. And this resort where you're holding it is just—it's, you know, like a little slice of heaven on earth there.
Oh yeah, no, it's great fun, and yeah, I just cannot sing the praises of eating in Singapore enough. There's so many different kinds of cuisine there, so it's really, really great.
These, your awards, the. The Pinnacle Awards, do you pair the wines with meals or anything, or is it they just taken on their own?
We do events in which we do pair wines with meals, and some of the wineries that are awarded are certainly part of those meals or those tastings. So we had a meal with a vertical of Chateau Margaux, and had a meal with Bond Estate wines from Napa, and did a vertical of Hinchke Hill of Grace, and that was great fun. I've been a fan of those wines for 30 or 40 years, and Paul and the Hinchkes themselves for all that time, and so that was fantastic to see them again and to taste those wines. So yeah, it's they're vertical tastings, there are dinners and such that all take place around it. But so much of it, like I say, is really just the process, the kind of intellectual experiment or exercise of deciding, okay, over the last 12 months, what rocked my world?
Mm-hmm. Are the same judges invited back every year? I mean, do you know that you're going to be back there, so you start looking for wines that might be a nominee?
I think that's a good call. Yeah, I think that's a really good call. In general, we have the same judges. There are some people that come in and certainly, maybe a few people that fall away. But in general, we are trying to add to our judging ranks rather than subtract from them, because, everybody's been handpicked, and they're all people that, we feel like have a great deal of experience. Like me, they know they're empowered to spend the next 12 months thinking, all right, maybe this wine, maybe I should try this wine.
Trying
to stay on top of it.
Yeah. That I was wondering about that, because I would. I mean, I think everyone would if they know they're going to be back. Every time you taste wine, you go, boy, that's pretty good. I might have to consider that for a nominee. And it would be a good way to start approaching a lot of the wines that I would be drinking if I knew I was going to be in that position. So, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Mike, do you have any questions, comments, anything for Doug here?
I do not. I'm checking social media right now. Nothing there. Not at this time. I did not catch at the beginning when you started talking about the Wine Pinnacle Awards. How long has it been going on? When did you start it? Or I probably missed that.
Yeah, it's started back in 2018. And, we were ready to rock and roll until the pandemic came along. So really, in terms of the, the big event and everything that we just did, this was only the second time that we had done that, because we basically laid off, 2020. We did it in 2019, and then 2020 came along, and 21, we weren't really past it yet. But 22, we managed to all get together again, and that was a wonderful thing.
Okay. Wow, I didn't realize it was only the second one. Are these published anywhere or anything? I mean, Annie got a hold of me telling me about the Pinnacle Awards. Otherwise, I would never have heard of them myself. Where do you find information on this? I mean, well, a lot of questions on this. Number one, where do you find the information? Number two, if people want to follow it, is there a website for it? And number three, how about wineries? If they think that they have something that is qualifies for a try to be an award winner, can they submit anything themselves or submit something to one of the judges? I mean, all that stuff, it just popping in my head here.
Yeah, we haven't really created a process whereby somebody can say, look at me, other than, I think that we publish and make known the names of the judges. So people can certainly, and I think somebody who's making a wine, at that level is going to know at least somebody on that list and can do the old, hey, what am I, chopped liver? conversation with somebody. The website itself is just www.winepinnacle.com. And so, you know, people can find out more about it. It has all the results on there, you know, explains who the jury is and all that stuff. And then tells people a little bit about what, you know, the master classes are that we run and the events that, that happen during the program.
Is there any monetary award for the winners or just the prestige of being a winner?
Just the prestige, yeah. They get a trophy. They get to take
well,
home a trophy.
That's something. I mean, you know, not everyone gets trophies. You don't
that's
have participation trophies. So
that is true. We do not do that.
Which is a good thing. Well, I can't think of anything else. The Pinnacle Awards were fascinating when I first read about. Are they always going to be held in November?
No, we are actually talking about moving the date. And so there's still some, I'm not absolutely certain what the date, the next date is going to be. But as long as they stay away from harvest, I told them, you know, I'm fine. With
no,
just
yeah.
Don't do it during harvest.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's true. Are the other judges, are they sit at home on the couch and drink all the good wine type judges, unlike you who has a vineyard and all that, or are they owners of vineyards and or even restaurants or something?
It's kind of all over the place. There's, like I say, master sommeliers, masters of wine, some of whom are, you know, active, and some of whom are just writers or educators or things like that. There are people who've won the, you know, best sommelier of the year, or, you know, win top sommelier in the world and things like that. So it's
wow.
All sorts of different people. And we try to kind of, like I said, create some diversity in the roles of the people that are actually voting. So we feel like we get a you know, differing viewpoints on it all.
It sounds like quite a diversified group of people there and highly qualified, to say the least. That's what you're looking for. Okay. Nothing else, Mike?
Well, I was just wondering, we're, you know, talking about your Master Sommelier and Master of Wine titles, a very limited, you know, one out of four. Do you keep in touch with the other three or? Yeah, three. Okay.
Yes, yes, in general, yes. Now, you know, sadly, one of the guys, the guy who passed after, the first guy to pass was a guy named Ron Wiegand. I haven't talked to Ron in some time. He lives in Hungary now. You know, he's kind of off the grid a little bit. I was the second person, and then the third person to pass both was a wonderful gentleman named Gerard Basset, who I often will just refer to as he was the best of us. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago. So there are really only three of us. Then the fourth to pass is a guy named Eric Hemer. And Eric lives in Miami and just a wonderful guy. And, yeah, Eric and I probably talk to each other every other month or so. So he's an awesome guy.
Wow, that's interesting. A very exclusive club, to say the least.
Yes.
I'm afraid so. It's true.
Wow. All of them are active in the trade, or?
Yes. Eric is in charge of education for Southern Glazers
Group. Oh.
And as I say, Ron is doing something in Hungary. I'm not really sure what he's got going on right now, to be honest with you. Gerard was the owner of the Hotel de Vin in London before he passed away. His widow and his son continue to run that. And continue to be very involved in the wine business and, you know, the sommelier competitions and things like that.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow, that's cool. Good question, Mike.
Yeah, that's
cool. So, before we go, give us your web address and contact information for your winery, and so anyone can look it up who is so inclined. You're not actually open yet, are you? When are you expecting to be built and taking tasters?
Well, we actually have a tasting room that's open in Walla Walla.
Oh, you do?
Downtown. So yeah, so that's ongoing, so that's available. People can just go to the website, which is www.echolandswinery.com, and they will find a link there to make a reservation at the tasting room and can learn more about us there and order wine if they want to. And pretty soon I'll start posting pictures of the winery as the walls are coming up.
Oh, great. We'll start looking forward to that. What's your shipping policy, different states?
Well, there are a number of states. Yeah, there are a number of states that we can ship to, Florida being amongst those. But, yeah. There, the world of wine shipping is still a little
crazy.
Bit in the dark ages. So there's certainly
there's
certainly some states that those states, they just would not dare want to let somebody, ship wine, some evil wine, because I'm sure there's some 16-year-old right now who's
waiting
2 weeks. He's dying to wait, 3 days or whatever for, expedited shipment.
Yeah, I know. Doug,
you and
I are on the same page now. It just drives me crazy as if some kid who wants to drink is going to order online and wait for a shipment to come in when they can go down and stand in front of the 7-Eleven and slip somebody, $20 and say, pick me up a 6-pack. And,
it's just protecting certain people's sales. I get that. That's the way these things work.
That's the way it works. Regardless of how insane it is, that's the way it works.
Yeah, hard to justify, but that's how it works.
Yeah, I know. So, anyone get in touch, and if you are in Walla Walla, Washington, you're going to be on the Washington side, right? Okay, so if you're in Walla Walla, Washington, then this summer it's going to be built?
Yes, we'll have it'll be done certainly by next fall of 2023. But the tasting room is open 5 days a week.
All right, there you go. Sunday, Monday close or Monday, Tuesday or?
Actually, Tuesday, Wednesdays or.
Tuesday, Wednesday. Oh, that's I guess wrong. So if you're out there, check it out, and if Doug's hanging out around there, I'm sure he would be more than happy if you introduced yourself and said that you heard him on All About Wine. And if we ever get an opportunity, I will definitely stop by and visit the place. And I appreciate you taking your time to join us tonight. I am really impressed. We'll start looking forward to the next Pinnacle Awards. And what's the website again on the Pinnacle Awards?
So it's winepinnacle.com.
Winepinnacle.com. So if anyone wants to check that out. Thank you, Doug, for taking the time. We appreciate it. And we wish you the best of everything. And maybe next year when the Wine Pinnacles come out again, we can get you on. And you can tell us about what wines were nominated and won from this year, or 23, I guess. So,
absolutely. That sounds great. I'll look forward to it.
Thank you.
All right. Very good. Thank you for taking your time to join us this evening.
Thank you.
Talk to you all later.
Have a good evening.
Uh-huh.
Thank
Bye.
You. You too.
Bye now.
Bye.
Okay. There we go. Wow. Yeah, I was looking at the map on their website. 7 West Adler in Walla Walla, Washington. So near South 2nd Avenue and Poplar, East Poplar Street. So in that block
that
area.
That's the tasting room?
Yep. That's what it shows, Echo Lands Winery. Yeah. So let's see. There's hours. There's quite a few. Yeah, Thursday through Monday, they open at 11 a.m. till 5 p.m. So, 4 hours.
closed Tuesdays and Wednesdays. That just seemed odd to me. Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Then, you know, okay.
Yeah. Very cool.
Nice website, though. I mean, it really is. It's a.
Yeah.
It's got lot of information there. Oh, wines. Let's click on that and see what he does have in wines. He's got Rub Rum, which is a Bordeaux-style red blend. It's the grapes used in it is 55% Cabernet, 37% Merlot, 6% Cabernet Franc, and 2% Petit Verdot, 13.9 alcohol. Seven Hills Vineyard, and that has 40% Merlot, 40% Cabs, 18% Cabernet Franc, and 2% Petit Verdot, and that's 14.1% alcohol. And then his Syrah is 98% Syrah, 2% Viognier, and it is 12.8% alcohol. So some nice wines there. Oh, wait a minute. Here's his Cabernet Franc that he's doing as a varietal. Let's see. Is that 100%? No, 97% Cabernet Franc. 3% Merlot. And then Pepperbridge Vineyard Cabernet, 97% Cabernet, 3% Merlot. And then a Grenache Rosé, which contains 100% Grenache grapes. So some nice wines that he's putting out there. Good area to grow them, too. So check it out. If you're out in that area or something, check them out. There are some wonderful all around that area. You don't have to just spend your day talking to Doug. You can go around and visit lots of other wineries.
Big area.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. I don't know if you have anything else to add. It's 8:02. Yeah, we have a show next week on the 22nd and Thursday, 22nd of December. So feel free to join us then.
Nothing important coming up between now and then. So, yep, just be safe out there. It's supposed to be some nasty weather. Ice and snow. There's a name of the storm. I heard the name of the storm that hit the Northeast once. I can't remember what it is, but they're naming the storms now. So, but be safe on the roads and everything. They canceled a whole bunch of flights out of San Francisco. There was a whole bunch of bad weather coming through there too, in different areas. So,
All right. Be safe. We'll see you all
Safe.
Thursday. Thanks for coming in. And if you'd like to be a guest, please visit the website allaboutwine101@gmail. What am I thinking? Yeah, email Ron if you want to get that. allaboutwine101@gmail.com or visit the website. What is it?
Or allaboutwine.com.
Yes.
Or if you're a publicist and you have clients that are in the wine business or like Doug, you know, and stuff. Get in touch with me. We'd love to have them on too. So,
yep. Let us know. We'd like to have you on. Thank you, and have a great week and a safe week.
Have a good week. Thanks for listening.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron. For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on this show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinedtr.com. Archive shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine.
All About Wine.
Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.
All About Wine.
And we're off.
We're off. Oh, wait a minute. I need to go to the green room.